Welcome to Come Inside. Today's guest is television presenter, journalist, and proud Indigenous woman, Nerelda Jacobs. Nerelda has been working at Network 10 for over 20 years. She's been reading the nightly news for Perth since 2008, and at the start of 2020, she joined Network 10's morning talk show, Studio 10, as a panelist and reporter. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Nerelda. We covered so many important topics, from her upbringing in a strict religious household to her coming out at the age of 21. We talked about Indigenous deaths in custody. We talked about politics a little bit. We addressed some comments that have been made from former Prime Minister John Howard. We talked about our experiences coming out and being a part of the queer community. So I really enjoyed this chat. I wish I had more time with her because there was just so much more that we could have spoken about. But not to worry, because we still touched on a lot of really important topics. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I think you will. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. To start off by really talking about your childhood, because I understand that you're the youngest of five sisters, right? That's a lot. Yeah. That's a lot of girls. Yeah. And yes. Then, so your father was Indigenous, your mother is Irish.
Yes, yep.
And they were pretty religious.
Yes, that's right. So what
was your experience growing up in that religious household?
There was a lot of love. First of all, there was a lot of love. Like, we were just showered in love and affection. And it was, and that also might be part and parcel of being the baby of the family as well. You know, everyone loves the baby and everyone kind of spoils the baby. And so I was constantly, you know, getting showered with love, which was really beautiful. We had a lot of discipline in our family as well, but, you know, like, healthy discipline. Boundaries were set for us all. And if we stepped out of line, then we knew about it. I just remember a lot of family time, like dinner times, we'd all come together and sit at the table, and then after dinner we would have like Bible readings or that sort of thing. And I just kind of thought that was what every family did.
Of course.
Grace at every meal, and a devotions time after dinner, you know, and I actually think that's what every family did.
Of course, when you're in it, so, that's what you think, right? Yeah. Like, you think this is normal. Right. This is what everyone's doing. Yeah.
Yeah, and everyone goes to church in the morning on a Sunday and then in the evening on a Sunday, and, you know, I didn't realise you had a choice.
Yeah, that's true. Do you do any of that now?
Not really. No, I don't. I don't go to church at all.
No, but that's okay, right? Mm. Like, that's okay. Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know. You know, it's funny. Something I had no idea about you is that you're a mother. I had no idea that you had a daughter. You have a lovely daughter named Jade who's extremely talented artist. I had no idea about this. Yeah, she's brilliant. I was looking at some of her work.
Yeah, I gave birth to a fully grown adult. That's what it feels like. What it feels like.
Yeah, because she's a fully grown adult, and it was like, whoa, you had a kid. But you were really quite young.
Yeah, I was 19 when I had Jade. She's 26 now, and she is just this most beautiful person, incredibly open-minded, fiercely independent. You know, as a self-starter, she created her business from nothing. You know, she was doing sports science at uni, and she came home after, you know, 6 months or so, and she said, I don't like sports science. I want to switch to Indigenous studies and fine arts. And I was like, that sounds nice. You know, what could that possibly lead to? You know, as a parent, probably every parent has those thoughts when their family wants to go into creative endeavor. And you know how hard it is for any artist to survive.
Yeah.
So I had my reservations, but she's having the last laugh because her business is absolutely incredible. Her artwork is everywhere in Boorloo, Perth. She's created a real name for herself, and she's a hard worker. She works so hard, and she does mural art, which is out of the elements. So it's physically demanding as well. She's on cherry pickers and scissor lifts and working at height and all sorts of stuff. It's just amazing. I'm so proud of her.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I'm trying to think, what was it like for you to tell your parents that you had fallen pregnant at such a young age when they're so religious. Like, I'm assuming they would have rather marriage and then babies or.
Well, that's why there was a marriage.
There was a marriage.
I was 3 months pregnant, and when Jade's dad and I told my mum, I couldn't really face my dad. My dad was a reverend of the United Church.
Yeah.
And we couldn't really face my dad. And so we sat my mum down and and told her, and she thought we were joking at first. And we were like, no, we're not joking. And so shortly after that discussion, she gets on the phone and organises the wedding. And oh, wow. I hadn't even been proposed to yet. Yeah, so that's how quickly it was. And it came from a well-intentioned place of she wanted Jade to be born knowing that she was born out of love.
Yep.
You know, and so that's where it came from. And I can't, you know, looking back now, we should never have got married. It would have saved so much of my parents' money. And it only lasted 6 months.
Yeah. So then when you have to tell them that you're going to get a divorce, is that even harder?
I can't really even remember.
It was a while ago.
I can't really remember. It was always doomed. It was always doomed. Well, because I'm gay, pretty much. Well, you know?
Which is what we're going to lead into, which is why it's so interesting. And I mean, it's kind of stupid that I just never knew that you had a child. And then I was like, you had a child and you were married? And then I was like, oh, but you were young. Like you were really young, and I was like, okay, really I get young. It. Yeah.
Yeah, and the reasons that the marriage didn't last were different from me coming out. That came out after we separated and things. So it was almost a blessing in disguise that happened because it forced, a reset, you know, that word comes up a lot during the pandemic. You know, everyone's resetting it. The pandemic forced us to reset. Well, I had a bit of a reset in my life at the age of 19, 20.
Yeah, okay. Because then is it 21 when you told your mum and you really came out and said, I'm gay? And, I mean, I know from my experiences of being gay and having to come out as well, it's such a confusing time when you're growing up and you're trying to understand how you're feeling and your sexuality and you're trying to make sense of it. And I'm wondering what that experience is for you because I didn't grow up in a religious household. So I'm kind of thinking it was a bit tougher for you.
Yes, because we, as well as all the love and the healthy boundaries that are set between parent and child, there's also a lot of fear and shame that goes into all of those teachings. Okay. In fact, you can pretty much find the fear and shame in all of the teachings.
In pretty much all of it,
you know, in my mind, which is why I was closeted for at least 3 years before telling my family, coming out to my family. And it's that internal turmoil that you feel, am I going to hell? That's the biggest one, am I going to hell? Because that's what it comes down to. And for Christians everywhere, their main goal in life is to save souls and to save people from going to hell. So for my family to learn that, because, you know, inherently gay people, LGBTQIA plus people are committing sin, so they're doomed to spend eternity in hell. There's no two ways about it. One equals the other. So that's why I was scared to come out to my family. But after realizing my own sexuality and developing that and exploring that, after 3 years with my partner Marion at the time, I worked with Marion in the public service. We worked together at Native Title Tribunal, and we struck up a really beautiful friendship. And before too long, I was really looking forward to coming to work every day to see Marion and have lunch with Marion. And then we started like catching up with each other outside of work, you know, as you do, you know, with work friendships. And then it kind of blossomed into something more. And we were together 3 years before. And I was closeted for that time from my family, not so much from, like, I was going out to clubs and bars and things with Marion, but I kept it a secret from my family. Yeah, so it was after 3 years, and I didn't want to be closeted, and I didn't want Marion to be closeted. So I made the decision to come out. It was really hard. You know, it was, I think I had a few false starts, actually, where I was like, okay, this is going to be it. And then I'd be like, I can't say the words. And so I'd leave that visit not saying it. And then you'd just be like, oh, I've got to do it. You just have to pluck up all the courage. And what happens is that when you rehearse it so many times in your mind, it's like when you do anything for the first time and you overcome with nerves. If you rehearse it in your mind, you just press autopilot, and the first word comes out of your mouth, and then you're committed to it.
Yeah, and then it just keeps going. Yeah, and you can't stop. Yeah. And you're like, oh my god, I can't turn this off now. Yeah, it's just like you unleash. I totally. Yeah, it's like the floodgates open.
But those first words are the hardest. I think it's probably like stepping off when you're doing abseiling or bungee jumping or something. You know, it's that first action that is the hardest. Yeah. But then it's easier from then, and it's just this feeling of just being free and the burden being lifted. And it was like, you know, it's like, why didn't I do that sooner?
Yeah.
I mean, there were tears. It was difficult. It was a really difficult conversation to have. But I was just, I felt free afterwards.
That's good that you just felt relieved, I guess. You're just like, okay, I can be me now.
Yeah. I left knowing also that I had the love of my family, because that's one thing my mum said, you know, I'll never be able to accept this, but I'll always love you. And so that was kind of, I knew it would never be accepted. I knew I'd never have that acceptance. And I accepted that because, I don't know, it's different. It's each to their own, and everyone knows their own family. And some people say, you know, unless there's acceptance, I don't want you. I'm not going to be a part of your life. Like, unless you accept all of me, you're not going to have any of me. And so it's been quite a unique situation within my own family, because I know that I'll never have that acceptance from my mum. If you can imagine Margaret Court, that is my mum. Like, that's pretty really? Much like you would never convince Margaret Court.
No.
You know? And so that's what I'm up against here. So I've had to make the decision. Do I want the love of my mum? And do I want to love my mum, or do I not? You know? Yeah. And so I've chosen to love my mum.
Yeah. I mean, that must be hard though. Like, there must have been times where you would have been maybe a bit angry and like, no, fine, then I'm not going to love her. Did you ever have those moments, or it was just like, you know what, this is how it is and I'll accept it and maybe she'll come around? Yeah. Or you know she's not coming around, obviously.
She's not coming around. No, she's not coming around. And this is, I've got a nephew who is very out and proud, Elisha. He is strong. He's a strong human. In fact, all the grandchildren are. And I suspect there are probably more LGBTQIA+ members of my family who haven't come out yet, or who haven't been born yet, you know, great grandchildren coming. And so you have them in mind, and we're going through a bit of a conversation within our family at the moment about that, because the world has changed since I came out, and people are expecting more, and all power to you, you know, to expect more and to demand more from your loved ones.
Oh, 100%. Do you think that you always knew you were gay, but because of that upbringing and being in that religious environment and being told, you know, it's a sin and all the rest of it, that maybe you just hide those feelings, you push it down, and you're just like, oh, you know, it will go away?
Are you speaking from experience?
Yeah, a little bit. it is such a confusing time. I've tried to explain it to people before, and I'm like, I don't know how to explain it. Because it's so confusing, because you, like, I was so confused to the point when I was younger that I was like, am I meant to be male? Am I meant to, like, I didn't understand what it was. So, yeah. And so you just hide it and you try and fit in wherever until eventually you just get sick of it and you're like, you know what, I'm gay, deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many times when I look back and it's an explanation. It provides a really clear explanation, and there was no two ways about it. I mean, I had teachers at school that I would bump into as an adult, and they were like, oh, we knew. You know, so when you have teachers at school and even my older sisters were like, yeah, well, we suspected. And it just provides this really, it provides a bit of clarity, like, okay, there was nothing wrong with me. And, I think it helps join the dots. And it's like, if you join the dots, it's like one big love heart.
Yeah. That's a really good way of explaining it, actually. That's true.
Yeah.
So then are your siblings accepting of it? They're like, they don't care, it's just part of the thing? Or are they a bit like your mum?
I have one sister in particular. She's a very staunch born-again Christian. And so we don't talk about it. And in fact, there's an element of straight out homophobia there. Yeah. She has children who she doesn't allow to go to my house or Elisha's house because she doesn't want them to be influenced, I guess. And yeah, so that's really upsetting because you know, I'd like to have a relationship with my nieces and nephews.
Of course.
Yeah, but my two older sisters are fabulous. They are so supportive and they're brilliant and and love them dearly. I mean, I love all my sisters dearly, but to be able to have that unconditional love is everything.
Yeah, it is. It's next level. Because, I mean, you have a partner, Stevie, who has your mum met her?
Yeah, mum has met her and she's only just recently, my mum, instead of saying, "How's Steffi?"
I love it.
She's actually
her name right.
She's made a point of remembering a name. So she's actually, saying, "Hi, how's Stevie?" You know, so that's, you know, my mum's come a long way. It's not like she puts up the walls every time, you know, she greets Stevie with a hug and a kiss and has a conversation and is welcoming. You know, she's Christian like that, but just not, I mean, she'd love to save our souls. And before we probably get there and after we leave, she'd be praying for us.
Yeah, okay. So hope this isn't too personal, but what happens if you want to get married? Will your mum turn up?
Don't think my mum would be there. I don't think my mum would be there. I've thought about this quite a lot. She would not deal with it. And, I mean, I'd invite her to the wedding, but I wouldn't think that she'd be there.
You can't see that happening. Is that hard for you? Is that hurtful? I mean, it must be hurtful on some level, even if you do accept it.
I don't know. I mean, it's this interesting notion of who is family.
Yep.
And, you know, for members of the queer community, it's who you choose. Your family is more often than not who you choose rather than who you're born into. And, I mean, I would love for my mum to give her blessing on our union, but I don't need it.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't matter to me that she's not there because I've not been able to talk to my mum about relationship things my entire adult life, really.
Yeah.
So it's like it's kind of no loss.
Yeah, okay. It's not like, you had that there and then it's gone and she was leaning on, for that. That's true. Yeah.
Like I have great conversations with my mum about career things. Like she's always been very supportive of career conversations, but as soon as you mention a relationship, I mean, she'd be there at a pinch, you know, but not, you know, I wouldn't, it's not my go-to.
Because does she watch you on TV?
Yes.
So if you, because you know, like you are on Studio 10 and so you've kind of, you're still the journalist, but you've kind of moved more into that, giving your opinion as well now on that. And topics would come up about homosexuality and transgender and all those type of things. Does she ever comment on that? I have heard you talk about her before, yes. But also like how does she feel about that?
I don't know.
She doesn't call you up and say, "How dare you? I'm your mother." No.
No, there'll just be a bit of silence, which is fine. But the thing is, every time I share the story about, you know, my poor mum, you know, she really cops it. But every time I share those stories, it resonates with people.
It does.
And the most recent personal story that I shared on Studio 10 was after it was revealed that Scott Morrison was Pentecostal. And everybody was steering away. A lot of commentators and panelists and members of the media were steering away from it because, you know, the Prime Minister should have the freedom to be the religion that he wants to. But having been someone who's grown up in and around that sort of religion, and as a teenager I went from, so I grew up as a Uniting Church. My dad was a reverend of the Uniting Church. And then as a teenager we kind of chose as, you know, as our own individual people, my sisters and I, to go into a Pentecostal church. And so I know exactly what that means. I know exactly, you know, what Scott Morrison's sets of values and beliefs are and how important it is to save souls and the fear and shame that comes with all of that. And I was really horrified to see how deeply he was in the Pentecostal church and how revered he was, because I know that it comes with a level of discrimination for so many vulnerable yeah. people in our community. And I had to talk about it because nobody else seemed, very few people seemed to be talking about it. And just to be able to give a personal slant on it to say, hey, I've lived in that fear and shame. If I didn't have a strong sense of self and a strong, you know, identity and sense of belonging in my own community, you know, there was no way that I would be able to live my authentic being, and I'd still probably be closeted and be racked with shame about who I am.
That's true.
You know, and not being able to live my authentic self. So, you know, if I've got to share my own personal experience and, you know, mention my mum without her, you know, knowing it, then and if it helps people, then so be it. I've got no problem with that.
You've got no problem. Yeah, that's fine. Because you've also, you know, been part of the lesbian and gay Mardi Gras. Your mum's not, wouldn't say she was happy about that.
No. Last year, so I've done 3 Mardi Gras now. The yeah. second time, the first time I didn't tell her. I was in Perth, and the first time I just flew to Sydney for the weekend and didn't tell okay. her what I was doing. Yeah. And then the second time I lived here, and I didn't tell. I didn't even bother telling, you know, any member of my family. But my mum phoned me on the Monday after Mardi Gras. And I phoned her back, and I was like, oh, I had a missed call from my mum. And so I phoned her back, and I was like, hi, mum, you know, how's it going? What's happening? And she's like, oh, lovey. I was like, what's the matter? What's the matter? She said, oh, it's what you did on the weekend. And I was like, okay. And I just, it was just this sick feeling that came over me. Yeah. It was just like, ugh, don't bring it up. Don't bring it up. And she expressed how disappointed she was. She just thought it was just this kind of disgusting display of, I don't know, like it, she just didn't want any member of her family to put their name to that. And I couldn't get off the phone quick enough because there was kind of a sense of how dare you bring this up. Like our mother-daughter relationship has, from the time that I came out, has kind of been built on a let's not talk about it. I'll leave you to your beliefs if you leave me to mine. And she kind of broke that because of that thing, like, I need to save your soul. You know, it's like, and we had it out after that. And I was like, you know, you don't need to save me. I'm very happy. So if anything, it was good to open those lines of communication, which is, you know, the lines are still open and we're still having those discussions as a family. Yeah, it's just that I'm never going to sway her and she's never going to convert me.
No, well, you can't convert. That's why it's funny that people think like you just wake up one day and make this decision and it's just, no. I mean, it's not that simple. It's nothing like that at all.
No.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. it's, yeah. I mean, it's good though. Like that doesn't stop you from wanting to be involved in that type of, you know, covering the Mardi Gras and stuff like that. You still love doing it.
Well, because we have a responsibility, I think, because there are people out there who can't come out for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And so by being visible, then it's you're sending a message to them. And I've heard the co-chairs of Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras say that it's not, you know, Mardi Gras, the broadcast of it isn't so much for the people who are lining Oxford Street, and it's not so much for the people who live in, you know, Darlinghurst and Surry Hills and all the, you know, the cities of Australia, Melbourne, and all the places. It's for people in the regions. It's for people who live with family members who can't be out, who can't have these conversations, who can't be visible. There's some stories that were shared with me. Albert Kruger shared with me the story of a closeted person in regional Australia going into their, literally going into their walk-in robe, into their closet, and watching it on their phone, watching the broadcast on their phone, you know. And so that's what Mardi Gras is for. It's the visibility for people who can't be out, or for people who are just coming to terms with it, or wondering, you know, how do I live my authentic life? And seeing people like them, you know, that's what Mardi Gras is all about.
That's true, because I guess like it's great to see people on TV whose families are like all about it and they're there marching and doing all those things, but it's also really important to see your type of situation as well on TV because, I mean, it happens and it happens a lot. I know a lot of people who have come out and their families are like, see you later. Like, disowned them, and now they have no blood family. But like you said, they created their own family within their own community, and it's just so sad. So it is important to see both sides.
Yeah. And look, everyone's got their own coming out journey and their own coming out story, their own families, and it's wonderful to hear when families are accepting, and it's the most beautiful thing. And you know, hold on to that. But you know, there are a lot of families who ostracize members of the family for being queer. So every coming out story is different.
Yeah, that's true. You're the first openly gay Indigenous woman to read the news, right? In Western Australia. It's a mouthful.
There's a lot of conditions.
I was like, hang on, there is. I got to tick all the boxes. To read the news in Western Australia. Is that right?
Yeah. There was,
you must be really proud of that.
Well, I mean, that's something that other people have drawn, have created. I joined Channel 10 in the year 2000 as a reporter and kind of just worked my way up. And, you know, other people had faith in me along the way to give me the presenting job. That was in 2008. I started presenting Perth News. And then at the beginning of last year, Stevie and I moved over to Sydney just to see what the next chapter in life holds, because I love to read the news in Perth, and you know, it's a real honour to be able to read the news, and it's a job that I loved. Yep. I didn't want to leave it. There was no reason to leave it.
Yeah,
just the fact that I was getting very comfortable, and I just wanted to see what other challenges there were out in life, and so did Stevie. So we decided to move to Sydney, which is what we did at the beginning of last year, and it's been great.
Yeah, until the country shut down. Until everything shut down, which is a big one. But then, so then you go and you transition into also doing Studio 10. So what are the main differences there? Are you really enjoying that new type of challenge?
I am loving it. Giving your opinions, well, first of all, as a newsreader, you're not meant to have opinions.
Yeah.
You're meant to just read autocue, and you're meant to read it fairly, you know, straight faced and not editorialize it by having too many expressions, and that's even hard to do, like to not have the judgy face, oh, look what happened today, really, you know, that type of thing. And
true.
When it's really obvious, I still read it like that, because you know, you want people to come with you. But I really loved that. That's the thing I've loved the most is about sharing my opinions, coming from a position of not thinking I had opinions. For starters, and then realizing, oh wow, my opinions differ to other people's, and where's that point of view been this whole time? And it's not until you're asked to join the conversation that you realize that particular voice or that point of view has been lacking. So I'm really appreciative of having, you know, moved over at a pivotal time in the world, and to be that voice during the BLM riots, and at a time where people are, you know, a lot of people are only seeing it in a very one-sided way. But to be that balance, and like I've kind of been describing lately, it's like if you can imagine, you know, the scales have been weighted one way for such a long time, and what we're seeing now is it's not, you know, the so-called woke or left or whatever. We're not tipping the scales. It's just bringing it back to balance.
That's
you
right.
know, so we're just bringing it back to balance. It's a point of view that we've lacked for hundreds of years, and now we're just starting to bring it back to balance. And it's been really exciting to be part of that.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally right. We're not trying to completely tip the scales. We're just trying to bring balance to it. And you're right. Like, then I don't know if it's out of fear that people say those things like, "Oh, they're the woke crowd," and everyone's going to be cancelled, and when people say all lives matter, which I just hate so much because it's stupid. Same. And, I mean, all lives can't matter until Black Lives Matter. Like, it's really simple, but they can't put it together.
Time for a quick break now. You're listening to Come Inside. Hey listeners, I just wanted to jump in here really quickly to tell you about my new movement. It's called Be the Change Movement. What I've learned over my life so far is that We seem to be a little bit more interested in listening to what people say so that we can respond, instead of actually sitting back and listening to understand what they're saying. For me, life is about evolving, and we cannot evolve if we do not educate ourselves, and that is what Be the Change movement is all about. Head to killereducation.com, click on the shop tab, read about the movement, and also we have t-shirts, hoodies, hats, beanies. We even have some baby clothes available as well, with more things to be released soon. Proceeds from the sales of the Be the Change merchandise will go towards the development of a creative arts rehabilitation program for incarcerated juveniles, as well as resources to fight wrongful convictions. Together, we can create change. So take the pledge to be the change the world needs. Head to killereducation.com. Now let's get back to the podcast.
So what does the Black Lives Matter movement, what does it mean to you as a woman of colour?
I just think it jolted Australia into realising when everybody started saying after George Floyd was murdered, when Australians were saying, you know, lucky we live in Australia, it really jolted us into realising, oh, that's our privilege saying that. And there are still people who don't realise their privilege, and that's they're the people that we need to reach, that are so tightly packed in their bubble that they're really difficult to reach. But it's seeing the penny drop when people realise their privilege. And I think that has been the best part of what's happened over the last year and a half is to being there to help people work through that. And I've been recognising my own privilege. You know, I'm financially secure. I'm non-disabled. You know, I've got job security as well. I have a purpose in life. You know, I've got a family who loves me. I had a school education. Like, I've got so many different layers of privilege that a lot of people don't have, even though I'm a person of colour. But you know, I recognise that I'm better off than a lot of Aboriginal people. And again, I have that responsibility to be that voice and to use that, because, you know, there are only 3% of the population of Aboriginal people, and yet we make up 30% of the adult prison population.
That's outrageous.
So we all have a response. We all have a responsibility. You know, we can't. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us haven't found our voices yet. But for the people who found our voices, we need to really yell it.
Yeah, that must be a lot of pressure, though, even though you can see that you have that responsibility and you take that on and you see where your privilege is, but there's still, I mean, it still feels like a lot of pressure.
Well, we draw strength from each other, though, and I met Mayne Wyatt for the first time a few weeks ago, and I told him straight out, you know, thank you for that monologue on Q&A that night, because it is like my armour. But every time I need to share something very personal, I will listen to that monologue. And I told Mayne this a few weeks ago, that by the end of it, I'm in tears, so that when it comes time to me doing something live or being a part of a panel or whatever it is, I can be really strong. It kind of really galvanizes. Yeah, so we draw strength from each other. And there are the most amazing people in every sector and every industry in Australia. Yeah. And we're all bringing it, and we're all doing it in our neck of the woods. And, you know, it's really naive of people to say, oh, Aboriginal people need to be doing more. Well, it's like, oh
my God, I hate that.
I just feel like saying shut up. And I've actually had a few arguments with people about that, because that's just like, that's their own savior complex talking. It's like,
yeah. And it's victim blaming.
We're doing it.
Like, it's victim blaming. It's a form of victim blaming, and people just don't see it, though, because they're like, well, I didn't hurt you personally, so, but it's not. We're talking about history here. We're talking about a lot of history and a lot of things, and we haven't rewritten those wrongs yet. Yeah, it's.
Yes, exactly. And people who say that, they are part of the problem, because they think that it's, something that other people need to do, whereas it's your attitude that needs to change, because it's the attitudes of the entire country that are changing. Yeah, and so that's so true. I'm glad you said that, because I felt that it's there's been so much victim blaming going on, and the intergenerational trauma is not that 10-year-old's fault who has is being taught a lesson by the community police officer for like taking a chocolate frog from the deli or something and locked up to be taught a lesson. It's like that is not that child's fault.
No, not at all. And I get so frustrated about that. And I guess I wish we knew the real numbers, but we know at least that over the last 30 years there have been at least 400 and maybe I think it's 74 deaths in custody of Indigenous people. And I always wonder, why don't these deaths get, like, they get very little coverage by the media, or they get none at all? And I'm like, why are we not showing that? And when you do hear a story of someone who's died in custody and they're Aboriginal, it just, you start to read, I make the mistake of reading the comment section every now and then, and you have people saying ignorant shit, and I'm like, what is happening here? Because they want to blame them. They're victim blaming them. Well, they should do this. Well, if they didn't do this, then that wouldn't have happened, and I didn't do that, so that's why I'm not in prison and they are. And it's like you're missing the point, because system runs how it was meant, like set up to run. That is purely how it is. And I have this conversation with people all the time, and I always have arguments with people because I'm like, the system was designed to work exactly how it is working right now. And that is, it's based off white supremacy. And people don't like to hear that, but it's the truth.
And absolutely.
So frustrating.
And even the phrase white supremacy is confronting for Australia. I think colonial patriarchy is a bit more palatable, but that is also white supremacy.
It is.
And we're so far behind having these conversations and being used to saying these phrases in Australia, because if you said white supremacy, people would just automatically switch off. They would switch off. They 100%. Would think that you're angry, that, you know, talking about things that happened in America. You're talking about the Confederates in America. You know,
that's exactly right.
The Root and Tootin people in the States. But yeah, you're right. Our systems are completely built on that colonialism and the patriarchy, that in itself, you know, look down on First Nations people. So that is white supremacy. That is white supremacy.
It is. And people, you're right. And people hear that and they get confronted by the phrase white supremacy. But that's what it is. Like, it's not, like people only think that is, I don't know, like almost like it's Nazi Germany or something. Like they think they connect it with something. Not that that isn't white supremacy, but it's we're talking about a different thing here. It is still a form of white supremacy.
Yeah, and getting back to deaths in custody, what a lot of people say is, well, if they weren't in custody, they wouldn't have died there.
Oh, I hate that one. It's so stupid.
If you do the crime, then you've got to do the time. But the thing is, a lot of people haven't done the crime and they're released without charge. And people are dying in there while they're on remand. They haven't been convicted. They haven't had their day in court, and they're not believed.
Yeah,
you know, like a lot of Aboriginal women, when they go to the authorities, and a lot of women just won't go because they know they're not going to be believed. And we're hearing harrowing stories of women who are going to, you know, child support agencies and authorities are asking for help, and then it backfires on them and their children are taken away. So a lot of people are now on top of the, you know, the suspicions of people in power and authorities, and on the back of the stolen generations and police doing the dirty work of the assimilation policies and things. I mean, all of those kind of values and beliefs are still there. It's still ingrained. The court system hasn't changed since those days.
Right? Yeah.
And Aboriginal people aren't believed and we're not respected.
Yeah, and have you experienced that a lot in your life?
I've had to think back, because when people, you know, when people have asked me in the past, have you experienced racism? My answer was no, I haven't experienced, because you think racism is the really overt things, like, you know, being called things to your face or,
yeah.
But as we now know, racism, it comes in all its subtle forms.
Yeah.
It's a lot of things. And I've had comments in workplaces, you know, I've had to leave work and get Jade in the evening. And the comment has been, oh, you're going to the soup kitchen now. And so I've just kind of made a joke or like, I think that was like, you know, what's a soup kitchen serving up tonight sort of thing. And I didn't say anything because you don't want to make things uncomfortable. But just recently also there was, I was going for a photo shoot and it was on the cover of the Sunday magazine in the paper. And I rocked up, this is only just a few months ago, and the man at the desk looked up as I walked in and he looked up and said, delivery.
Okay.
And I was thinking, I'm not holding a package. I don't have a package. I don't even look like a delivery person. Yeah, I didn't want to say I'm here for a cover. I just was like, I'm here for the whatever the publication was, and he pointed to the door and I walked in and there's everyone like ready to go. I think they were a bit smart because I was a little bit early. But, so I was, It's just bits and pieces like that. People underestimating you, having low expectations of you, constantly surprised that you are where you are in life, or putting the entire race down by giving you a compliment, which is more upsetting. You know, having low expectations and then dealing with the surprise and then having the compliment backed up with a compliment. It's not a compliment because you are now just dissing an entire race of people, and that's really hurtful.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, being white, I have zero idea what that is like, but I don't know. It's so like just messed up. Like that comment.
Yeah, it really
making
is.
Making a stupid comment like, are you off to the kitchen now? Or this, like, it's so. It's just racist. Like, and there will be people that will hear this and will be thinking, why is that racist? But it is racist.
Because it feeds into people's negative stereotypes, because that is what people think an Aboriginal person is, that we are characterised by disadvantage, and we are not. We are a proud people.
Yeah.
And the history is for everyone to be proud of that history that we have. Because as soon as we shift from feeling sorry or feeling like you are all disadvantaged to being proud of this oldest continuing culture in the world.
Absolutely.
And being the first engineers and the first astronomers and the first scientists, the first doctors, nutritionists and irrigators.
Newsreader in Western farmers. Australia, come on, say it. You've got to give yourself credit.
Yeah. once you shift that thinking from being only the negative stereotype, you know, it's life changing.
I think it's such a beautiful culture, and like, look, I don't know enough about it, and I wish I would learn more about it, and I should, but I just love it. I don't know, being like one with the land, and I love Aboriginal art. It's like one of my favorite things to look at.
Yeah. Well, it's the answer to the future is getting into a First Nations mindset is the answer to climate change. It's the answer to a lot of social harmony, you know. So what's really frustrating is when people hear about culture and you're sharing, you know, a story or whatever, and they look at you and say, oh, you must be really proud. And it's like, well, it's not for me to be proud. I'm inherently proud. You should be the one that's proud. Are you proud?
Yeah, that's
true.
You
know, it's not for you to. It's not for me to be proud of my own culture. Like, of course, I'm proud. Are you proud?
Yeah.
You know, so that it's when people stop. Yeah, making it about you and your culture. It's like, well, it belongs to you as well.
That's true. I just find it weird that we don't embrace it more. You know, we look at the NRL and the AFL, for example, and they have the Indigenous round, and I think, well. Shouldn't every round be like an Indigenous round? Like why do we only choose that one weekend where we're like, yeah, okay, we're going to pay respect to the traditional owners of the land.
Mm.
But like every other week, we just, who cares?
Yeah, there's so much change that's going on now, which is really fantastic. Like even Australia Post will recognise traditional place names as long as the postcode's on there and the street address is on there. You can put Boorloo for Perth or Lutruwita for Tasmania, all the other places, and Australia Post will recognise it, and that's a beautiful thing. Great. You know, what's a really beautiful thing is to see all meetings begin with an acknowledgement of country and people actually being able to speak in with language, using a bit of language as well, which is really great. People even knowing who the traditional owners are on the place that they live and work is really fantastic. So the next generation coming through and they're, you know, learning this, if not at home, at school, like Australia is going to be a different place. It's going to be really beautiful, a really beautiful place to live. And there's so much going on now. It's really great.
Yeah. You're feeling positive about the changes that are happening and you're hoping that,
yes.
I mean, of course, it's not enough. Like, you know, it's not enough, but it's a start. And I guess that's something to feel positive about. Where would you like to see it, I guess, go?
Yeah, well, the systems that we were talking about that Australia operates on and the world operates on, all are serviced by individuals that come from different walks of life with their own values and beliefs, and they've been raised a certain way. And, you know, they're not all forward-thinking, progressive people.
Yep.
So for, you know, the underpinning the Uluru Statement is the truth-telling aspect. So, you know, the voice to parliament, the treaties and truth, the truth-telling aspect. So for this next generation and generations to come who the truth-telling, they're going to hear the real version of events and the reasons that there is the intergenerational trauma that Aboriginal people have experienced for centuries. They will understand why these things are happening. So for that generation to now come and to learn language, to learn the history, to be proud of the traditional customs, why we do a certain thing, you know, to be in that First Nations mindset, to be one with the environment, for example, then those people are going to be the police officers, the teachers, the nurses, the doctors, the child support officers, the lawyers, the judges, you know. So it's about changing the values and beliefs of an entire society.
Yeah.
And that is what is happening now.
Yeah.
So that's why there's so much hope.
That's true. I mean, we've got a long way to go, but it's good that we're starting to make the change and more people are kind of getting on board. When you hear about, so if I use the Adam Goods situation, which is just outrageous, just all that racism and everything that was really thrown at him. And I mean, champion player, probably the best Indigenous player to ever play the game of AFL, to be pushed out of the game the way that he was in that way. And now he has no part in it. How does that hurt you as an individual? Like, you must really feel that. Like, he does a war dance to celebrate a goal and everyone's acting like he's threatening people, but it's part of the culture and there's nothing wrong with what he did.
Yeah. You know what? It this is probably a bit of a surprise, but it hurt me because I didn't have the awareness at the time that it was happening. And it was only in hindsight with the documentaries, really. And it's like, I think everyone was like, where was I during that whole thing? Like, why didn't I stand up and say something and show my support for Goodsy, you know? I think it was a lesson to everyone not to be complacent and think that, oh, that's happening on the other side of the country, that's affecting other people. But especially in this day of social media where we can all be connected, we're all connected, and we can show our support for each other. The importance of a message of support, or, you know, the power of actually just putting out a statement or on your own socials is so powerful because it shows it's that visibility again, you know, it's that visibility. Yeah. And I applaud him for knocking back the Hall of Fame, the offer of being in the Hall of Fame. I really, because that just goes to show how deeply this scar is, how deep the wound is and how long the scar will take to heal, if at all.
Yeah, and when you hear people say, well, he should just get over it because it was years ago, so just get over it, like don't hold on to it, are you like, what are you talking about? Because it is. It's that scar, yeah. And it's just he was hurt, yeah. And he had, of yeah. course, he was hurt, and he has every right to knock back that. And I think that it's horrible. Yeah. Like, I agree with his decision to do that. I think he should make whatever decision he wants. I hope in my lifetime I get to see him inducted into that Hall of Fame, yeah. because we should be able to celebrate this great player. But,
yeah,
you know, yeah. this is what happens. Because these are the consequences, right?
The AFL didn't support him then, and what's to say the AFL will support another player now if it happened now? And that's yeah. the key. I mean, Collingwood has gone through what they've gone through last year,
yeah.
And that was just last year, you know, and that was true. and that was Eddie at the time of what happened to Goodsie, and Eddie was the big man, and went yeah. and had a chat. That was really tokenistic then, obviously, wasn't it? Because of everything that's gone on in Collingwood, they didn't learn from that, and that's now. So it's yeah. like, yeah.
And you see I mean, there are still comments being made to these players. I mean, we see it in the NRL with Latrell Mitchell, for example. Like, he's copped a lot of abuse and threats and everything online from people. And it's like, what is wrong with you? Like, why? I just don't get it. I don't know. I just can't understand what the point is. Like, being a keyboard warrior, like, what's the point of doing that and
yeah.
hurting these people?
Yeah, there's a saying, it's better to be hated for who you are than loved for who you aren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I stand by. Like, I don't care. I'd rather my own communities be supportive of me. And I don't really care about what everybody else thinks, as long as I'm representing, you know, the marginalised voices who yep. haven't been represented in mainstream media for the longest time. Yeah, so I don't really care. I don't care for trolls. I don't engage trolls, and I don't think, you know, people like Adam Goods does either. But
yeah.
if you cop that from one of your own, then it would be like so incredibly upsetting. And I think that's what he felt about the AFL yeah. not coming out and supporting him. You know, that yeah, would have been absolutely. The same thing.
Well, I just think it's also weird that we put him up on a pedestal when he does something amazing in the game, you know, Adam Goods, but then he does something culturally and we kind of attack him for it. Like, it's weird how people pick and choose when to really love him, and he's amazing and he did this amazing stuff on a footy field, but he comes out and says, that girl just said yeah. something racist to me in the crowd, and she gets kicked out.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's like he's this monster.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly like what Mayne Wyatt said in his monologue. You know, if you're a good black, then good things will happen to you. You know, if you toe the line, then you are promoted. As soon yeah. as you call something out, you're a problem. You know, that's why it's just so important that we all use our platform, because it's easy. It's easy not to.
Yeah.
But you just have to. We just have anyone who has a platform. Like, you just need to use it, because there's safety in numbers for starters. Yes,
that's true. There's and I think numbers. I don't think it matters. Like, you got 100 followers, 100,000 followers, or 100 million followers. Yeah. Use your voice. I totally get it. I mean,
yeah.
I will say to people out there, if you're going to use your voice, which is great, like, people will come for you. I get it all the time. I get a lot of hate and a lot of threats and a lot of but I don't care. But I don't know. It's just, like, the right thing to do, to be a part of that solution. Then
yeah.
I don't want to sit back and be like, you know, one of those people who are like, well, I'm only one person. What's my voice going to do? I don't think that's yeah. a real thing.
And you know, you know that feeling when you know that something is right. Like, you just have this burning, you just need to get it out there. You need to tell people what you think. And that comes with knowing that you're on the right side of history.
When you hear not just everyday people but politicians say things like, when the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, say, you know, there had been no slavery in Australia, or you have the former Prime Minister recently, John Howard, who is a white male, deny that racism exists in Australia because it hasn't been his experience as a white person. I mean, it's so ignorant and irresponsible for him to say that, but how do you feel when you hear those type of comments made?
It makes you feel like they are the Prime Minister of a certain part of the population, because how can a Prime Minister not know that there was slavery, and that's something that he quickly understood to be false.
Yeah.
There was so much slavery in Australia, and for him to say that was really upsetting. For John Howard to say that there's no racism, that is absolutely his privilege. And it comes down to this thing of this thought of, you know, if you work hard enough, good things will happen to you. But good things don't happen to everyone who works hard. You know, you can be a law-abiding citizen your entire life and you'll be racially profiled in the shops.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be, unconscious bias will come into play your entire life and you would have paid all your taxes, you know, and, it's wrong. It's wrong, and people have their head in the sand, they're ignorant, and it's their privilege talking. It makes you really angry.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess, yeah, like you said about Scott Morrison, it does feel like he's the Prime Minister for a certain section of people. You know, it's not even necessarily just white people, because he's obviously homophobic. I mean, it's just simple.
Yes.
So, when I heard what John Howard said, I couldn't believe.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe that he said that. I was like, I thought we've moved past that. But
when it's so far away from your own reality and all the things that you stand for, I'm in disbelief as well. Like when people say all sorts of things about, you know, gender neutral language and how wrong it is. I mean, it's like. Oh, don't even bother. Let's not even bother with it, you know.
Is that how it feels sometimes for you? You're like, I can't be bothered battling with you about something that's, I don't know, a non-issue, like when you talk about that kind of.
It just seems so obvious to me to be inclusive. Like, let's be inclusive of the people who felt excluded for the longest time. Like, what's so hard about that? And that comes into that white supremacy of, like, constantly wanting to be bigger than constantly wanting to keep people oppressed, to be to keep things inclusive. I don't know. It's awful. I hate that whole narrative. It's getting hijacked by people who are trying to bring in that fear, you know, that we're losing a grip on life as we knew it.
Yeah, which is ridiculous. Last thing I just wanted to ask you was, what would you say to the allies out there or people who want to be better allies? What would you say to them about what we should be doing and moving forward? Because I think it is a bit of a – I always say I consider myself to be an ally. It's something I take a lot of pride in. I'm very passionate about it. But I've made mistakes. And I feel like any good ally will make a mistake, and it's about learning and evolving and growing from there. What would you say to people?
Yeah. We have our different intersections in life, don't we? And as members of the queer community, we know what it's like to, you know, not to be treated equally or equitably. And then if you sit that alongside, you know, First Nations culture, and you have some empathy to what that is like, but imagine sort of being in the intersection then of homophobia and racism. And I've kind of been thinking about this a little bit, that, you know, when we brought in the marriage equality, it was a bit of a sign that said that Australia was coming to terms with its homophobia, that most Australians, or 67% of Australians, voted yes to wanting marriage equality. And yet we're still talking about bringing in constitutional change that will recognise Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as inhabitants of this country. So does that then mean that Australia is less homophobic than we are racist?
It's a very good question, isn't it?
Do you think it's a distraction?
Like, okay, we'll do this thing for marriage equality, and if that passes, then it's a distraction from doing other things that should have been done a long time ago?
Yeah, I just think that it says that Australia, as Australia as a country is more racist than we are homophobic. I think it's as simple as that. And we all need to, as allies, stand up for that 3%, because we will be a better country for it. And the allies that have stood together through all of the things over the last year and a half, there is so much love in the room. You know, there is so much love in the room because we are doing what is right. And they are really awkward, uncomfortable conversations that we're having, but they really need to be had, because we can't have generations of the future coming and thinking those same things. And we're tearing down those systems, which is just brilliant. And that's why there's so much hope. There's so much hope because we're all finding our voices and we're all standing together and using those voices. And it's a really beautiful thing.
I love it. You're like, it's really beautiful. I could cry. It is lovely. It is. I just wish, I don't know, I get impatient as a white person, so I can't imagine what it's like to be an actual Indigenous person going through this, where you just want things to move quicker, I guess, and you just want, I don't know, more change and stuff. But, yeah, thank you for talking to me.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
I've enjoyed
it. I really love the conversation.
Yeah, I could have kept talking to you forever. That's the problem when I get on roll with people. Yeah, I really appreciate it. I think it's going to be very helpful for people
to hear. Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm really glad. Yeah.
It's really important.
To end this episode, I'm actually going to do something a little different. You would have just heard Nerelda speaking about the monologue that Maine Wyatt gave on Q&A. And so I've decided to end this episode by actually playing you that whole monologue that he did. It's extremely powerful. All I ask is that you listen to it with an open mind and an open heart. And the sad thing about this being a podcast is that you don't actually get to see his facial expressions. But you can jump on the ABC Q&A YouTube channel and watch it. I've heard it so many times and it still brings me to tears hearing it. It is just so powerful. So that's how we're ending today's episode. I want to thank Nerelda for coming on and being so open and honest and teaching me, and hopefully a lot of you, about how we can all be better allies and about the truth. So thank you for listening. As always, remember to be the change the world needs. But for now, I'm going to end it with Maine Wyatt's monologue from Q&A.
I'm always going to be your black friend, aren't I? That's all anybody ever sees. I'm never just an actor. I'm always an Indigenous actor. Hey, I love reppin', but I don't hear old Joe Bloggs over here being called white Anglo-Saxon actor, blah de blah. I'm always in the black show, the black play. I'm always the angry one, the tracker, the drinker, the thief. But sometimes I just want to be seen for my talent, not my skin colour, not my race. I hate being a token, a box to tick, part of some diversity angle. Oh, what are you whinging for? You're not a real one anyway. You're only part. Well, what part then? My foot? My arm? My leg? You're the blacker, you're not. You want to do a DNA test? Come suck my blood. How are we to move forward if we dwell on the past? That's your privilege. You get to ask that question. As we can dance and we're good at sport. You go to weddings, we go to funerals. No. You're not your ancestors. It's not your fault you have white skin, but you do benefit from it. You can be okay. I have to be exceptional. I mess up, I'm done. There's no path back for me. There's no road to redemption. Being black and successful comes at a cost. You take a hit whether you like it or not. Because you want your blacks quiet and humble. You can't stand up, you have to sit down. Ask the brother boy Adam Goods. A kid says some racist shit, not ignorant, racist. Corner, black, fire and ape, come on, man. We was flora and fauna before 1967. No, actually, we didn't even exist at all. But he got it. This was a kid. This was a learning moment. He taught that kid a lesson. But did they like that? A black man standing up for himself? Nah, they didn't like that. You shut up, boy. You stay in your lane. Anytime you touch a ball, we're going to boo your ass. So he showed him a scary black, throwing imaginary spears and shit. And did they like that? Oh, nah. They didn't like that. Every arena, every stadium, they booed him. It's because the way the flog plays football. Bullshit. No one booed him the way they booed him until he stood up and said something about race. The second he stood up, everybody came out of the woodworks to give him shit. And what, he's supposed to sit there and take it? Well, I'll tell you right now, Adam Goods has taken it. His whole life he's taken it. I've taken it. No matter what, no matter how big, how small, I'll get some racist shit on a weekly basis and I'll take it. You know, it used to be that in your face, your bong, your black dog coon kind of shit. Gonna chase you down the ditch with my baseball bat skinhead shit when I was 14 years old. But nah, we come forward, we're progressive. We're gonna give you that small, subtle shit. The shit that's always been there, but it's not that obvious in your face shit. It's that, oh, no, we can't be seen to be racist kind of shit. Security guard following me around the store, asking to search my bag. They're walking up to the counter first and being served second or third or last kind of shit. They're hailing down a cab and watching it slow down to look at my face and then drive off. More than once, more than twice, more than once, twice on any one occasion. Yeah, that shit I'll get weekly. Sometimes I'll get days in a row if I'm really lucky. And that's the kind of shit that I'm letting them think they're getting away with, because to be honest, I can't be bothered. I can't be bothered teaching their ignorant asses on a daily basis. I don't have the energy or the enthusiasm. It's exhausting, and I like living my life. But then on occasion, when you caught me on a bad day where I don't feel like taking it, I'll give you that angry black you've been asking for, and I'll tear you a new asshole. Not because of that one time, because of my whole life. At least Adam danced and they still pissed and moaned. But it's not about that one time, it's about all those times. And seeing us as animals and not as people, that shit needs to stop. Black deaths in custody, that shit needs to stop. I don't want to be what you want me to be. I want to be what I want to be. Never trade your authenticity for approval. Be crazy, take a risk, be different, offend your family, call them out. Silence is violence. Complacency is complicity. I don't want to be quiet. I don't want to be humble. I don't want to sit down.